for joining us. I have Mark Coletti on the phone. It's a pleasure to have you, Mark. Your current role is what?
My current role, what it says on my business card is staff scientist.
But you have an engineering background.
Yep. Once upon a time in a previous life, I was a software engineer.
Software engineer. Okay. And how long have you been doing your current job or role?
Well, you know, what's kind of funny is that I'm 53 years old, and it's hilarious that they actually deem me as an early career professional. So I've actually only been hired on as a staff scientist for a couple of years. Coming up, you know, more than a couple of years, because I'll be, my third year is going to be this August. So I'm almost 3 years as a staff scientist.
And that's why they consider you a newbie to it?
Well, you know, what's kind of funny is that there's actually an early career professionals group at work. And so I asked them, well, you know, there's not like a sort of an international standard of what is deemed an early career professional. But for scientists, it's generally about 10 years. Sometimes it's 5 years. So even at my age, I'm considered early career because technically I've only been a full-time scientist at the lab for a couple of years. Now, mind you, I was a postdoc for a couple of years before that. So really the clock started ticking when I actually graduated with my PhD in May of 2014, which is coming up on, oh my God, 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So prior to this, you were a software engineer, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. I'm in the Washington, D.C. area, and work for a variety of companies doing mostly government contract work, which is typical for a software engineer in the D.C. area.
And is that something that you knew you always wanted to do, Mark?
Well, here's the funny thing is early on, I knew that I wanted to go into research. So in a sense, of software engineering was sort of a means to an end, because I'm the kind of person that I try and lift myself up on my own bootstraps. So I knew that if I got hired on as a software engineer, I would have enough income where I could kind of pay my way through school. And typically a job you have as a software engineer, there's usually is one of the perks is tuition reimbursement. So I knew it was going to kind of slow me down because I would only be able to kind of plod along, taking a class at a time at night. But I knew that if I just bided my time that I would actually finish grad school. And along the way, I would actually pick up skills as a software engineer that would be actually helpful to me as a scientist way on down the road. And that actually turned out to be completely true. It took me longer to get through the system, but it was completely valid. So I've actually picked up a lot of skills that have actually helped me a lot in my current job by deciding to be a software engineer along the way to get to where I am right now.
I'm having trouble seeing where the word scientist comes in. So can you explain a little bit more about what your current job is?
Sure. So as a one way I describe being a scientist is that you're learning things, but you're learning things that are special in the sense that you are learning things that no one else has learned before, which is really exciting. And then you get to share that with everybody else. And that then you get to kind of relive your excitement all over again.
You're almost inventing a process. I mean, if nobody's ever learned it before, it's almost a discovery than a learning,
it's exploration, it's discovery. That's really the kind of the essence of being a scientist. And there's a certain giddy joy that comes along with discovering something or learning something that you know that you are the first human being to actually learn this one little thing or see this particular phenomenon. To kind of give a good visual, So just recently, and it's not in my field, but it's been all over the news where we're actually finally able to take kind of a picture of an actual black hole. And what was cool about that is that there was an early career scientist, a woman, who was actually instrumental in kind of bringing together the pieces to put together that first picture. And there is a photograph of her that captures that perfect moment where you can tell she is seeing something. You can see her laptop in front of her where the very first image of that black hole is being rendered. And she is, that's a moment in history. No one else has seen that. She is the first one. And that look of just giddy joy, that kind of captures the essence of being a scientist. You kind of strive for those moments where it's like, cool, I have this really burning question that I want to answer. And then it's like Christmas. When you get the data, you kind of unwrap it, you do the initial analysis and visualization, you go like, wow, that's really interesting. And I'm the first person to see that. And now I can share that with everybody else. And there's a certain sense of just giddiness that comes along with it. It's just a lot of fun.
That's awesome. And one of the things that you already said, how the early training, the early education that you got contributed to where you are now. So when I ask you the question, you know, what is it, you know, what's really important to know if someone's going to be in this particular career you're in, what are some of the other things you would say about it?
So if somebody wanted to kind of, you know, fall into my, you know, where I'm at right now is if I had, in a way, it kind of recasts your question, is if I could go back in time, say, and give younger me a little bit of advice to kind of help nudge myself along, what kind of advice would I give? And it would be basically the same kind of advice I would give for anybody that kind of wants to maybe be a scientist someday. And one of the weaknesses I have and I still struggle with today is that I try to do everything myself. And that means that, you know, from time to time you get stuck and you'll kind of spin your wheels and you're not going to be able to make any tangible progress. And I would linger in those doldrums way, way too long. Don't be afraid to go out and talk to somebody else. It doesn't have to be your advisor. It could be just a colleague. Sometimes talking through the situation you're in can help move you along. So that actually kind of held me back. That problem that I had is that I didn't actually seek help when I really needed to.
So what kind of challenges would you face on a daily basis that one might, you know, you should go get some help, man.
Right. Well, you know, I'm one of those people that if I have too many options, I tend to kind of vacillate. But, you know, all I need is a nudge. Is somebody that's kind of, you know, an objective observer, you know, can say, well, okay, Mark, you have all these different options. Here's what you could do to kind of narrow them down. It's like when you go to a restaurant that has too big of a menu, I'm one of those people that, you know, I'm just going to be doing hand-wringing for way too long to figure out what it is I want to order. So it's kind of a variation of that problem. As you're learning, from time to time, you'll get in a situation where it's like, I don't know what to do next. I don't know what are the next steps. I know what the ultimate objective is, but it's really murky about how to get from point A to point B. And you could just go to somebody else and just kind of relate where you're at. And they might be able to kind of hand you sort of a life map to tell you, well, here are some likely routes that you can take to get from A to B.
Do you work alone in teams or independently and part of a team as part of the job you do right now?
I guess the flippant answer would be yes. You know, I'm being kind of serious too, because there's certain elements where I do spend a lot of time by myself, but I'm working on projects with other folks. So there's a sense that, you know, I am on a team and there's some common objectives for stuff. But from like moment to moment, a lot of the times I'm sitting, you know, by myself in my office, but I also will, you know, when I need to chat with other folks. And what's kind of interesting is that, you know, welcome to the 21st century, you know, we kind of work remotely. Like I have a PhD student that's working with me on a project and he's up in Rochester. So we actually chatted today online to kind of work out some of the things that we need to do for the next set of experiments that we need to run. So in a sense that even though I'm by myself, I'm virtually not by myself because I'm constantly interacting with people, whether it's through email or through chat systems and stuff like that. And what's also kind of interesting too is that the work I'm doing is that I'm not on any one project. If you talk to most any scientist, the model I like to use is the spinning plates model, is that you have like maybe three different projects, right? So they're like three different spinning plates. You have to keep going. So your attention kind of jumps from one thing to another. Yeah, and each one of those projects, you're going to have different people that you're going to be working with. And what's kind of cool for me is that it makes things a little bit more interesting is that in a sense, every project has its own personality. You know, sometimes you have projects where the team members have to meet on a regular basis. And some projects are a little bit more loosey-goosey where you don't have to meet as much. And that just overall just kind of makes everything a little bit more interesting. It's not the same old from one thing to the next.
And that variety is part of perhaps of a good personality trait would be liking that variety then for this kind of career choice. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head is that, yeah. You know, for somebody who like maybe likes to have things really kind of structured and very well laid out, being a scientist is probably not necessarily a role that might be a good fit for them. Because it's kind of the nature of the beast, right? One joke I have is if as a scientist, if we knew what we were doing, it would be engineering. I mean, it's true. That's part of the job is that we don't know what we're doing. And we're learning what to do in a sense. So yeah, you're exactly right. You know, for somebody that really prefers sort of a rigid, structured job, and there are plenty of jobs that are like that, then being a scientist is probably not a good fit.
But you went from being an engineer to a all over the place, multiple projects kind of guy.
Yeah, because at the risk of contradicting myself a little bit is that to do my work, I have to do some engineering. Oddly enough, because I'm a computer scientist, and so part of that job is that like any other scientist, I have to run experiments. So if you're a chemist, you have to run experiments. If you're a biologist, you run experiments and stuff like that. Computer scientists are really no different. We also have to run experiments, but unlike messing with rats or bacterial cultures or anything like that. Is that we have to do some programming to support our experiments. And this is where my software engineering background comes in handy because I'm able to kind of design and implement the experiments in a kind of a controlled, principled fashion such that it means I'm less likely to screw up when I'm actually running my experiments. And it also means that the software that I use for my experiments, if I engineered them correctly, I could not only share my results, I could share the software too for other scientists that are doing the same kind of thing. And that also kind of makes me feel good because, you know, as humans, if we do something and we share something, whether it's food or music or something that we do, we feel good. And it's the same thing with your scientist. Because you feel good when you're sharing your results, but if you're a computer scientist, if you can share some of the other stuff too, like the software you wrote, in the hopes that it could be helpful to other people. Well, you know what? That makes you feel good too. You're making a contribution in other ways too.
That's awesome. And would you approach it anything differently now that you know what you know, Mark? What was that? Was that a ha? I know. What was that?
You're Right, because I'm trying to, I guess, kind of understand the question in a way that I could answer it effectively.
Like, would there have been a shorter path? Would there have been, aside from being able to take classes without working it, you know, doing it at night and that kind of thing?
Right, right. I mean, I could have just jumped right into grad school, but that would have been even back in the 90s would have been a little bit harder, in the sense that already we were seeing kind of a move in the 90s where students had to pay their own way through grad school. So it was harder to get grants and scholarships and that sort of thing. So yeah, there's not really much I think I could have done besides, of course, you know, making sure that I got more help and more advice along the way to kind of get me out of the doldrums. To get me where I am, where I'm at, I can say something that's related to that. Sort of like one of my life philosophies is always try and put yourself in a situation where it's likely that something interesting is going to happen, and that's what college is about, and even more so grad school, because it kind of addresses one of the things that I struggle with, or I think we all struggle with, is that we know that there are things that we don't know. Like, for example, I don't know, there's a lot of things about biochemistry I don't know because I'm not a biochemist. But I could fix that, right? I could, if I really was interested, I could go and pick up those books and start learning. But then there are the things that you don't know that you don't know. Those are the gotchas, right? Yeah. And so what you do is put yourself in a situation where you're likely, through random encounters, to run into some people or into some literature or what have you that you otherwise would not have run into, where you will discover there were things you didn't know you didn't know, that you can go like, wow, that's actually really important. So I think
has to be comfortable with being ignorant, because that's the definition of you don't even know what you don't know, and that's okay.
Right.
Actually smart to recognize that you're ignorant.
Right. Well, and that's part of being a scientist in a way, is ignorance management.
Ignorance management. I love it. That's so smart.
Yeah, but it's true. You know, you kind of know, it's like, okay, well, these are the things that not only do I not know, but I am aware that, because I've done literature reviews and stuff like that, I'm aware that none of us know this stuff. And it may be something important to know. And so, yeah, in a way, science is just collective ignorance management.
Wow. That's an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, it is. I haven't really thought of it that way before. So that's cool.
So did you end up here, or did you intend to be here?
I did not intend to be here.
Uh-huh.
And that was one of those things where, again, it comes back to always put yourself in a situation where something interesting is likely going to happen. So like most people that was finishing up my PhD, is you're coming down that last mile and, oh God, you get tunnel vision. Because you've been, this thing's been hanging around your neck for literally for years, and you are ready to be done and move on. But the thing is, because you have tunnel vision, you haven't really thought about what you're gonna do after you graduate. So I had an old buddy of mine, he was up at Penn State, and he was a professor up there, and he knew that I was coming down the conveyor belt, finishing up. And he knew exactly what kind of situation I was in, because he has his own PhD. He knew exactly what it was like. So he said, Mark, why don't you come up and be my postdoc at Penn State? I said, thank God I don't have to worry about what I'm going to do after I graduate. But I also knew that this friend of mine, he had a lot of connections, which increased the likelihood of something interesting was going to happen. So I went up to Penn State for a year. It was my first postdoc. And sure enough, something interesting happened while I was there. And that is that some fellow came up from the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, his name was Budu, and he gave a talk. And what was cool is, I don't remember the title of his talk, but I guarantee you everybody who went to that talk remembers the subtitle. And the subtitle of his talk was, How I'm Going to Waste Your Next Hour.
Nice.
So right off the bat, I like this guy. It's just like, okay, this guy's got a sense of humor, right? And then I, you know, I sat up and paid attention to his talk, and he talked about all the cool things that were that there was that his team, his group was doing at Oak Ridge. And I said, wow. And again, it comes back to put yourself in a situation where something interesting is going to happen. And I said, this guy is has nothing but an interesting thing factory. He's got all kinds of interesting things going on down there. So let me go down there to Oak Ridge and just kind of plug myself in and see what happens, you know, and see what kind of interesting things happen to me. And so that was back in 2015. I've been at Oak Ridge ever since, and it's been one interesting thing after another. So it turns out I made a good choice.
That is so cool. It's clear you love your work, and it's a unique personality, I would say. Perhaps you don't know that, but you're surrounded by them. But for somebody to want to live by the putting myself in a situation where something interesting is going to happen is wonderful, and it's expansive, and it leaves the door open for unlimited possibilities. And that's a great personality trait for kids that are listening to know that if you have that sense of curiosity, what's over here? What's over here? Were you born with a box cutter in your hand, kid? Let's go. Box, what box? You know, let's do it. That kind of personality style is wonderful for what you're doing, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah. Yeah. It's all driven innately by curiosity. And that's what humans are. We're animals that are curious. I'll tell you a real quick story. So there was a famous science fiction writer by the name of Ted Sturgeon. His back in his heyday was back in the 60s, I think. And when I was a pimply-faced youth, all of 18 years old, I went to my first science fiction convention, and he was a writer that was one of the guests there. He was the guest of honor. And so I got some of his books, and I stood in line where he was signing books, right? So I was all nervous because this is the first famous person I've ever met, right? So I was a little, you know, overwhelmed, right? So my turn, I'm getting up to this old wizened guy with like a long pointy wizard beard, right? And I nervously put the books that were his to sign in front of him. And I noticed something. Around his neck was a pendant. And on that pendant was a really strange symbol. It was a Q with an arrow through it. Now you see something like that and you know it's gotta mean something, right? So sure. I was all nervous, right? And I asked, Mr. Sturgeon, you know, I see this pendant on your neck. What does that symbol mean? And he was about to sign my book. The pen was poised in midair, and he stopped and he put that pen down.
Uh oh.
And he just beamed at me.
Oh.
Big smile, and it just like shone at me like a spotlight. And he said, "Son, I am so glad you asked that question." And he holds out this pendant and he points at it. He says, "This symbol represents that always ask the next question. Always ask the next question." Because he says, the moment that humankind stops asking the next question is the moment that the human race goes extinct.
Ooh, that's a big statement. Wow.
I was 18 years old.
Wow. Right.
I will never forget that. Those words were just baked into my brain. But it is so true on so many levels, not only for the entire species, right? But it was also really true for me. And I just carried those words with me from that moment forward. And that is the very essence of being a scientist, is always ask the next question. One after the other after the other.
I love it. And especially if we preface it with how, and because how implies there's an answer. How can we figure this out? How can, whatever, the word how really does make a difference as
right.
to why isn't this working? Well, you get those answers too, but it's probably not the ones you're looking for. Yeah.
Well, you know, but in my case, the how is the engineering part. So, okay. So you know, why is this happening? Well, to answer the why, I have to want, how am I going to answer that question? How am I going to get to the why? And so that way I engineer the programming to support answering that question. So that's where the kind of the dual role comes in, where I can lean on my old experience as a software engineer to help me be a scientist. And I find that now And I have students, I have mentees. I actually got this kid that's at Rochester. He's coming down to Ornell in a week. And so he's your typical, you know, computer science grad student, and that he doesn't have any real programming experience. Well, this is where I can help him, right? So I look at some of his code, I go, you know, if you just did this way, or you did these things, your code will be better, it will be less brittle, and it will help you down the road to do better science. So I'm able to kind of share, you know, some of my, you know, time as an engineer with the next crop of scientists that are coming up, to kind of help them a little boost. And that's actually also part of the job too, right, is mentoring. And I like that. You know, it's good to know that, you know, some of the things that I can pass down the line is helping the next generation coming up.
Is there any, as we wrap this up, Mark, is there any advisements that you might have to the kids that are listening as to focus on grades or external extracurricular activities that would be beneficial to them?
Well, yeah, you know, I guess grades are important and all that, but it's the experiences that you get, the connections that you make. You know, I'm still friends with some of the professors I had when I was an undergraduate. It's those connections you make outside the classroom that in some ways are more important than the classroom itself. And I'm not saying that the grades are not important. They are also, you know, are important, but there's some of the, a lot of the learning happens outside of the classroom, just hanging out with people on campus that are like in the same field that you're interested in, and just talking to them, you'll learn so much, you know, because the classroom is there to kind of lay down the foundational knowledge that you'll need to kind of go forward in life, but when you talk to the colleagues and find out, you know, what is it you're working on, and what questions are you pursuing? You know, that's where you kind of tap into the kind of knowledge and the skill sets that can actually really, really help you for the rest of your life.
Is there a focus of sciences or maths or anything for, say, the high schooler who's considering listening? Because it's very exciting to listen to you talk about what you do. It really is. Very compelling. And, well, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So you know, yeah, I'm a computer scientist. So, of course, you know, computer science related classes are important. You know, programming classes. And chances are, if somebody is already a student, is already engaged in this, what you might find yourself doing is doing stuff for fun, for programming for fun. And here it is. I'm 53 years old, and just recently, I was in something called a hackathon. So to kind
Ooh,
of
explain, I love hackathons. Those are a blast.
Hackathons are a blast. And so it was great. It was here in downtown Knoxville. It was just a weekend. It was just 2 days. It was over a 24-hour span. And you had people that were in high school all the way up to geezers like me, right? You had people from all walks of life, you know, men and women. We were all having fun. And what was really cool is that there was kind of a focus to the hackathon. And the focus was the city of Knoxville is really kind of on the cutting edge for a lot of different things. And so what the city of Knoxville had done is they approached this group here of local hobbyists, really, and said, you know, we're struggling with some things that we figured that the hackathon could help us out with. And so they posed a series of challenges that if you met these challenges, you actually came up with solutions and even just a 24-hour span, these solutions could actually turn out to help the community.
Yes.
And so the team I was on, it was a waste management problem, which doesn't sound like a sexy problem, but it was an easy problem for us to tackle. And that was that if you have people that repeatedly have problems with their trash, their trash is overflowing, or a car is blocking, and what have you, the city wanted to send out postcards, right? But they were using like a spreadsheet, they were using a clunky manual system, and me and my buddies that formed the hackathon team says, you know what? Now, we could come up with something, boom, just like that actually would automate this process and make it a lot easier for the city. And we actually, there were prizes. We actually, we won 3D printers. So there was, so we had, we had intended to do something right, to put together a solution that would actually work for the city. But you know what? I think that even if they didn't offer prizes, we would have still have done it because it was just a lot of fun.
Congratulations.
And everybody there was having fun too. And everybody was learning. You know, I, even at my age, I was learning stuff, you know, working with my colleagues, you know, I learned stuff about databases because I'm not really a database guy. So it's like, oh, okay. So I learned a few things myself. But in looking at the high school kids that were there and the college kids that were there, and I could tell they were really getting a lot out of it, especially when they were coming around and talking to us about kind of the, what kind of stuff that we were doing and how we were doing things. So they learned from us. We were learning from each other. And that's always a positive and fun experience.
That sounds fantastic. Congratulations to you and your team. And the inventions that come out of a hackathon are amazing and useful and public knowledge. So yeah, accessibility is, you know, all of a sudden it's everybody's. No wonder we're making exponential leaps and bounds in advancements because of the community of sharing. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful part of what you do. Are there any other things that you wish I had asked you about what you currently do that you think a young person should know?
Well, I'm trying to think. We covered a lot of
we
stuff.
We did. It was pretty comprehensive.
Well, I would say that, you know, especially if you're like in high school or even in college, because you know, you're kind of maybe floundering around trying to figure out what it is you want to do. And I'll tell folks that are that age is that you may change your careers several times. And it's not that you didn't find a good match. You might have found a good match, but then as you grow older, you grow as a person and you may literally just grow out of your job and get bored with it and you want to do something else, right? And that's just part of the natural progress of life. And so in a way, even though I kind of knew what I was going to be doing, I kind of did that because I was a software engineer and I could have just stayed that. I was comfortable. I was making good money. But I knew that I was going to kind of molt, as it were, and change into a different person to get to the career that ultimately wanted. So it may be that you don't be afraid to change things if they don't feel right. Don't feel like you're locked into something. If it doesn't feel right, change it. Do something.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said it that way, Mark, because there's a consistent theme here of people following their inner knowingness or their heart or the nudges. And sometimes you just can't ignore them. And sometimes that still small voice is still a small voice. And it can be, you know, challenging to listen to when surrounded by people that are perhaps pressing the thumb on a child's future and their decisions and saying, "You thou shall follow." And the truth is that that person doing that doesn't have to live that life. You do. Yeah. So that's great, great closing advice. Thank you.
They're doing their children a disservice by forcing them onto the career, even though they may have their best interest in their mind, and because you know they're the parents, right? But no, ultimately you got to follow your own dreams.
That's right. We all came here to do something. It's just, what is it?
And it may change too, you know.
Right.
You may do multiple somethings, and that's okay.
It has been an absolute delight interviewing you. Thank you for your contribution to society, to our future, to all the things that you're building and doing, and how excited you are that when you bring that energy to your job, it changes the outcome. And it's clear you have found something to be so passionate about all the time. And bravo to you. Thank you so much once again for sharing your insights and wisdom and stories and advice. This has been fascinating.
Well, you know, and thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Well, we really appreciate it. This is going to be a great project that will help a lot of children to be able to make a better and more informed decision. You may have more mentees in the future.
All right.
Thank you again. Thank you all for listening. Stay tuned. We will no doubt have another interesting interview in a career that you never expected that you might want to do.
All right.